Then she says, now we can all get some sleep.
Now you see, Jason, this bloke is what you call a freaking idiot. Now come here and help me with this. Now today, gentlemen, you're going to learn the ancient art of putting the body into the barrel. Now, obviously, as things currently stand, this prick won't fit in, will he? So what do? I introduce you to my good friend, Uncle Machete. Comes in very handy at awkward moments like this. I've got to go to a party. Give us a yell when you're finished. Go on, don't wait for the flies to get to him. What the...
I can't. I...
Right. I've got it. I'll get you started. Battle Effect, I got it now!
Meet Mr. Death, Dennis Allen, a multi-millionaire drug-dealing murderer who terrorised Melbourne through the 1980s. Tonight, through dramatised scenes, first-hand accounts and psychological analysis, we examine the life and crimes of Dennis Allen, the man known as Mr. Death. He was violent, unpredictable, a drug-dealing criminal in a near-constant state of drug-fueled paranoia. He would turn to murder in the blink of an eye and was responsible for up to 10 murders, many in his own home.
Dennis Allen was just a complete fruit loop, you know, just a nutcase. What can you say about Dennis Allen?
He's an extremely violent person. He wouldn't pull any punches. He'd kill people with swords, guns, axes.
I'll get you started.
There's certain people that are just real low lives. That's where I'd put him, mate. He was a lowlife.
He was the sort of crook who would kill a man or a woman, for that matter, through paranoia. They didn't call him Mr. Death for nothing.
If you stick a bit in, I'll have him chopping up your body,
Ma. A murdering, psychopathic, drug-crazed, genuine Aussie nutcase.
At the height of Dennis Allen's drug dealing in the 1980s, he was making between $70,000 and $100,000 a week. He bought cars, houses and flashy jewellery, all with cash. He also bought his freedom by becoming a police informer. He injected speed 24/7, which only aggravated his already violent nature. He was the eldest son of notorious crime matriarch Kath Pettingill. She had 10 children, most with substantial criminal records, but Dennis was the worst. Kath believed he single-handedly destroyed the family by turning them into soldiers for his own criminal empire. Such was his penchant for killing at home that Mr. Death earned a second nickname, Dialer Death. He would invite people to come over on the pretext of buying drugs, only to murder them in full view of his family. Outlaw motorcycle gang member Anton Kenny was shot and dismembered in Allen's home, and he was just one of many. But the Dial of Death moniker may be misleading. There was little sense of planning in Allen's life. He often committed murder on impulse and without regard for consequences.
I think on occasions, Dennis Allen's murders were premeditated, but I'd suggest that on other occasions, they were very much spur of the moment due to the fact he'd been on benders, he was high on drugs. And he was of a psychotic personality. I mean, he wasn't a man to look sideways at a lot of the time. That could be enough to make him snap.
He'd fly off the handle. One afternoon I went in there and he had a dog that was a cross between a German Shepherd and a Great Dane and a Doberman. Anyhow, he gave the dog a bit of a kicking. I said, oh, it's only a pup, leave it alone, you know? He said, if you want it, take it home, it's okay. So I put it in the car and we took it home. At 3 o'clock in the morning, my wife said, look, I just don't want the dog here, it's enough for the kids. So I took the dog back, and I think a week later, Dennis Allen complained the dog kept barking, and he told her, better quieten that fucking dog down. So he walked out with a sword and chopped the dog's head off. It was a terrible piece of good.
He was a man as a cut snake ever since I've known him. He started off as a sharpie, skinny as a rake, covered in tattoos, and he had a short haircut with long tails down the back. That's the way he looked all his life. And even when he was a multimillionaire, he used to get around with white overalls on, Dunlop volley runners, with $250,000 with a goal around his neck, right? Driving GD Fords and just leaving them in the street when they ran out of petrol or something.
I mean, this guy didn't sleep. I mean, he was running around taking speed constantly. After a while, he had the tourniquet applied constantly so he could just, you know, constrict it and get some more into him, you know, and he's also living right in the back of a railway line. There's constant noise, constant comings and goings, and this guy wouldn't sleep for days and days. He became extremely paranoid, and certain people would feed that, you know, his enemies or his friends who wanted to get square with somebody else might, you know, G Dennis up to actually assist them.
Dennis Allen's mother, Kath Bedingill, would become aware of her son's more gruesome crimes.
What about the murders? How many people do you think he killed?
Well, I think I know about five.
Some say there could be as many as 13.
Yes, but I don't know all those people.
Journalist Paul Anderson got to know what happened to Anton Kenny when Allen's nephew approached him to tell him his story. Jason Ryan was only a young teenager when he witnessed some of Allen's appalling crimes.
Jason Ryan told me that that the bikie group had approached Dennis and asked him to kill Anton Kenny. Dennis gleefully accepted the contract. They were sitting at a table having a bit of a discussion. Dennis pulled a gun from under the table, according to Jason, and unloaded.
He was as nutty as a fruitcake. When they're chopping up Anton Kenny, the Hell's Angel, they've got him in a 44-gallon drum.
Apparently the chainsaw got a bit clogged, so Dennis had to employ a meat cleaver as well to finish the job. Anton was then stuffed in a barrel, which was then thrown in the Yarra River.
He's got blood over it. He says, oh, let's go up the pub for a drink. This is hard work.
That guy got it now!
And I've gone up to the pub, and it's full of workers from the Richmond Abattoir. They've all got white overalls on, covered in blood. They said, oh, we're part of the slaughter room you're working at, Dennis. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, I'm down the back there where you can't see me. And they all got the joke, and in the end, that he was doing something.
The murder of Anton Kenny was probably the most gruesome of all Dennis's crimes and murders. Wendy Pierce told me that she actually came into the place with Victor Pierce while Dennis Allen was cutting up Anton Kenny's body, and Victor Pierce had grabbed one of Kenny's feet and chased Wendy around the house with it. So this was the level of madness they were living in.
Forensic psychologist Bob Montgomery believes this grisly incident provides a window on Allen's psychological makeup. He believes the killing was a ritual to showcase Allen's power over his family and associates.
His behaviour, and a lot of the cases you'll look at, you will find those elements of what's called the power thrust. They're getting high, getting rewarded by feeling that sense of, I am powerful, look what I can do to other people. And that becomes often as important to them as whatever the other material, utilitarian goals are. So not only is this achieving some end for me, but it's demonstrating for me once again what a powerful person I am.
So this is a guy who doesn't care about the consequences of his behaviour. He doesn't really care about good or wrong. He's just doing what he's doing. He's evil by our judgment, but by his judgment, it's day-to-day stuff. And that's the thing that we all have trouble with, because we all live our lives by rules. We understand this thing called the social contract. We won't go so far, because if we go that far, then we lose something that we value. He doesn't value anything except himself.
The Yarra River was just walking distance from Allen's Richmond home. It became a burial site for many of his victims, including the dismembered corpse of Anton Kenny. Dennis Allen was born in 1951. He grew up with Kath Pettingill, a woman he believed to be his sister. Cath was in fact his mother. His first real home was Olympic Village, a public housing estate initially created for athletes when Melbourne hosted the Olympic Games in 1956. The Olympic Village was hailed as a new high in public housing, but the suburb degenerated into a ghetto where crime was a daily fact of life. Alan quickly found his way into trouble. He was before the courts for a string of property offences while still a child, recording his first conviction for theft at age 13.
Dennis grew up in a criminal family. From an early age, that's what he knew. He'd grown up, small arm robberies, petty thefts, assaults.
He was born into Victoria's most notorious criminal brood, I guess you could say. They were known as the Clan. Cath, his mum, was referred to commonly as the matriarch. He had notorious brothers, Victor Pierce being one of the state's most notorious bandits and drug traffickers.
Dennis Allen also honed his criminal skill when he was sent to the notorious Turana Boys Home.
When people go in and they go through the juvenile justice system in the old days, certainly, where it is a gladiator school, then they come out often a lot more upset about society in general. They feel they don't fit. They're made not to fit. And because they're now labelled misfits by society, they often see that as being a reason to become a misfit.
Children need consistency in their world. And so somebody like Alan, who's growing up in the consistency of violence, very quickly would learn that this is how it is. So he was skyrocketed into a life of hurting others, and better off to be the one that was hurting than the victim who was being hurt.
Now, if you come from a very nourished background, you could still be a sadistic murderer. But if you come from a background where crime is seen as the norm and you go to a juvenile justice centre where you are debased, you are belittled, you are demeaned by the system, and then you realise that the only way to survive is to be a lot tougher and meaner than your colleagues, and then you go to an adult prison where being a vile, cruel, larger-than-life person is a way of obtaining status and friends and influence and leverage, then you come out of prison with a particular personality. And that personality lends itself to certainly a lot more crime and a lot more violence than would otherwise be the case.
Despite their start in life, Cath Pettingill claims she tried to break the cycle of crime with Dennis and all her kids.
And I swore that I would look after my kids no matter what. And I used to dress my children in T-shirts when they were young, and it said, "My son, the doctor." I never wanted them to become criminals. I don't think any mother wants their sons to become criminals.
Alan's formative years were unhappy ones. He didn't know his father, and a procession of his mother's boyfriends moved in and out of his life. It was a tough environment. The only mentoring he received was in violence. This created the foundation for his sadism in later life. Of the many moments of cruelty he endured, one stood out in Alan's memory.
Of you, Dennis Allen.
I know, there was no shade.
Told you about getting burnt.
The midday sun's no place for a white fella.
That's not what Richie Banno reckons.
Let's see if he makes old bones.
You won't know to know Richie Banno is in 5 years. Hey, and don't answer back, you little prick.
I'll handle this, Dom.
No. You told him not to get burnt, and he did. He's got to learn to toe the line and bloody go off the rails.
Oh, shut up. You're not my old man. What's it gonna do with you?
Let me show you something about something.
What are you doing, weirdo?
Showing you what she's meant when she said don't get burned.
Hey, go easy on him, love.
Well, you want him to grow up with no respect? And take tape off.
Hey?
Get off me, dog!
Hey!
Go to the pub. Bugger you.
Now, you brought this on yourself, all right? I told you not to get burnt. Let's get this tape off. Come on. You better to get off as quickly as possible.
There's a good chance that Dennis became a lot more violent because of the environment he grew up in, rather than because he was intrinsically a violent, cruel person. He would have grown up in an atmosphere where violence was seen as being a communication tool, and violence was seen as leverage with people that you wanted to do things, you wanted them to do things for you, or to keep them quiet. So if that kind of communication tool, that kind of social interaction is approved of and encouraged, then Dennis, as a cruel, violent individual, would have become a lot more acceptable in that atmosphere than if his mother had come from another social class.
If anyone's going to be feeling pain in the future, it's not going to be him. I think he's also picking up the fact that the world's unfair. It's a really dangerous place. He picks up the fact that you can't trust anyone. The people supposed to care for you won't, don't. They're the aggressors. So he's picked up by the age of 9 that the only way to get along in this world is to make sure that you get in first, you can't trust anyone, and that if there's going to be pain, then someone else better feel it, because I'm not going to keep doing this.
So it's a case of him being a cruel person to begin with, but becoming more cruel because the environment encouraged him. It actually fed him. He would have been rewarded because he would have not been bullied at school, he would not have taken insults from people, and he would have been a lot more meaner than he may well have otherwise been.
Dennis Allen grew up understanding that violence begets violence. He'd come to learn the law of the urban jungle, that only the callous and brutal succeed. In 1971, at the age of 20, Dennis Allen was sent to jail for the first time as an adult. He was convicted of kidnapping and gang raping a young woman. It was an unspeakably violent crime. The woman was held at gunpoint in a home while Allen and 3 other men took turns raping her. Allen was sentenced to 9 years in jail. He became a small-scale drug dealer in prison. He nurtured his contacts, among them heroin dealer Alan Williams. By the time Allen was released in 1975, after having served just 5 years, he was ready to take the next step and become one of Melbourne's biggest drug dealers.
Dennis was just a real knockabout, rough criminal who got involved in bashings. He was, you know, caught up with rapes and a fairly familiar background until he got into the drug trade. And once he got into the drug trade and was really coining big money, he became more dangerous than anything.
The personal story of Dennis Allen is tied up with drug use. And I think he was a speed addict. He dabbled in heroin. Every drug known to man. So he'd moved into that milieu. And so to supply his own habit, he began to traffic as well. So you acquire the skills of that business as you go. And he was very, very good at it. And he also had a family network to fall back on as well. He and his brother Peter, who was older, had a thriving business. I think they were dealing inside jail for a while even.
Dennis Allen's drug dealing would make him a fortune. According to estimates, he made about $70,000 a week through the 1980s. In today's money, that's close to $14 million a year.
Well, the sky's the limit. I mean, he was running the town there. He was the man when it came to heroin dealing.
Imagine, he said, whenever you went in Dennis Allen's place, you could sit there and pick up between 9 and 10 grand whenever you just sat on the couch. It'd be rolls of it at the back of the couch, rolls of it, you know, just stick it in your coat, you know.
Allen would use his younger brothers as foot soldiers. His nephew, Jason Ryan, was just 13 years old when he found himself embroiled in Allen's criminal army. And over the course of his time with his uncle, he would be witness to at least 3 murders.
Jason Ryan grew up under the influence of Dennis Allen. He was born into that cutthroat family, so he didn't really have much of a chance of living a life of a clean skin, or what criminals refer to as squareheads. Dennis used Jason for his criminal exploits, used him as a drug mule, sent him out to do armed robberies with his uncles. And Jason told me he was very scared of his uncle and felt obliged to become complicit in his criminal activities a lot of the time for fear that, I guess, his uncle would kill him.
all their family, they used to use as foot shoulders. I mean, Mayor Charlie and Ray Kane went around to Dennis Allen's place once, and there's young Jamie Pennegall's got a 22 caliber young American, and he's going like this to the cat. He's going bang, 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 and he's pulled the trigger and he's gone bang, and the gun's gone off, and he's actually shot the cat. And Dennis has turned around and says, "Oh, good one, Jamie. Good one."
A drug addict, as well as a large-scale trafficker, Allen could be paranoid. In this state, he would turn deadly in seconds. He discovered that one of his small-scale dealers, a prostitute and junkie named Helga Wagneg, had been arrested. Allen believed that she would inform on him, so he called her up and invited her over. He had a new supply of heroin, he explained, and it was an invitation a heroin-addicted woman could not resist.
"Yeah, babe, it's cool. But they treated you good?"
"Yeah, they were right."
"Are you sure, babe? I mean, them pigs are dead set. I mean, what are they picking you up for? How much gear did you have on you?"
"Only a few grams."
"Then I'll be back on the street by tomorrow. Anyway, you'll be looking for something, won't you? Why don't you come over and we'll have a party?" "If you're good, I might give you one of these later on. Here you go, darling." "You're right, darling." "Come on, you fuck knuckle! Jesus! Poor darling. Shouldn't have gone in the river if she doesn't know how to swim." "And that, my friend, is how it's done."
Helga Wagneg was a prostitute and regular drug customer who'd approach Dennis whenever she needed a hit. Dennis believed that she was, ironically, a police informer, and through paranoia he decided to kill her. According to Jason Ryan, Dennis gave her a hot shot of heroin, didn't quite kill her. Dennis then ordered Jason to run down to the nearby Yarra River with a bucket. Dennis then proceeded to pour that water down Helga Wagneg's throat. Jason recollects that she reminded him of a whale. She kept spitting the water out and wouldn't die very easily. Apparently it took Dennis several attempts to actually drown her, and then her body was thrown in the Yarra.
"It's not hard for a drug dealer to get an addict to come on over. I mean, a lot of drug dealers do get a kind of Caesar complex that they can command anything they want. And paranoia, total paranoia without any spark of reason at all or some very arbitrary reason, would be enough to send Dennis off and convince him that Wagneg was an informer."
If he believed that she was going to put him into the police, and if that belief was well-founded, or if that belief was well entertained by his drug-affected personality, then she would have been guilty until proven innocent. And I would imagine her protestations about, "I'm not involved in this," would have simply been a way of confirming that she probably was. So I would imagine that he was of the belief that she was likely to go to the police, and he would have seen her removal as being an effective strategy.
Dennis Allen had a number of nasty nicknames. He was best known as Mr. Death, but his propensity to commit murder in his own home saw him earn the name Dialer Death.
He was a creature of habit. People used to say that he'd ring you up and ask you over to kill you. So there was numerous murders carried out in within his empire of properties in the Cremorne area of inner city Melbourne.
"Why don't you come over and we'll have a party?"
A lot of drug dealers like him are housebound people. So if you're going to kill someone, you're going to get them over. And a lot of his murders, I think, were spontaneous. I think he just went off his skull.
you and I think of a home, this is the last place I would want something like that to happen. But here's this guy saying, I don't mind using my home as a place to kill people. It's a very different concept of home, and given his history, not surprising.
I think Alan probably had a compulsion to enact some kind of ritualistic blooding, so to speak, and he could do it at his own pace in his own home. It was like a gambler playing a poker machine. He goes into a sort of a trance where, you know, step A, step B, step C. It was very empowering for him, and it probably gave him a sense of relief when it was all done.
Alan's drug business became an empire in the 1980s. It was the biggest heroin and amphetamines dealer in Melbourne. Alan purchased two houses adjoining his headquarters in Stevenson Street. The two houses cost just under $100,000 each, and he paid for both with cash. Alan's neighbours soon became used to the sounds of screaming and gunfire at all hours of the night and day. The police started a full-scale investigation to bring Alan to account. They maintained a constant vigil over his three homes, setting up their operations in an abandoned factory in Stevenson Street.
Myself and my crew went over to see Dennis Allen in one of the houses that he owned in Richmond. And at the end of the street, there was the old Rosella factory. And it was common knowledge to everybody that the federal police and the state police were doing a number on Dennis. So we were under surveillance and we were most probably on sound every time we spoke to him.
There's a story about how when there were some policemen there doing surveillance on him from the Rosella factory just up the street somewhat, he would get in these paranoid rages and walk out and ping a few shots at them, you know, in, as they were doing surveillance. And other police were asked to ask Dennis, please don't shoot at the guys in the Rosella factory because they're only doing their job. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. Because he was a lover of police. Paradoxically, for a guy who was so on the other side of the law, he loved police, would always assist them.
Alan had a strangely ambiguous relationship with the law. He distrusted the local police and he knew that a task force had been established to investigate his activities. But he knew how to play the game. Alan assumed the nickname of Gus and became a police informer. He assisted them in locking up a large number of criminals. This created tension within the Victorian police force. There were those who believed Alan was a dangerous criminal who needed to be locked away, while others considered his information far too valuable to see him taken out of the picture.
I don't get it.
It's all about the greater evil.
The greater evil? Isn't that Dennis Allen? Who's worse than him?
Don't use his real name when you're talking to him. It's Gus, remember?
He hands us a couple of dumb as dog shit robbers and we're just supposed to forget about his crimes? This is bullshit.
Look, it's the way it works. It's the way it's always worked. You try to make any sense out of that, you'll go mad.
He's the biggest heroin dealer in Melbourne. We've got him down for 5 murders. And just because he fizzes on a couple of dodgy stick-up men, he gets a pass?
He's a good fizz geek. Now put your fucking head in. It's Gus, remember?
Hey, Ted.
Gus, Detective Constable Brian Jammers.
Brian? Nice haircut. Your mum must be very proud of you. You gotta smoke them clean out.
So, Gus, this is getting to be a habit. What do you got for us?
See, this is what I don't like, Brian. We've lost the art of conversation.
We've got work to do. It's a busy day, Gus.
So little time, so many social engagements, eh? Militano, he's been a bit of a naughty boy.
He's a mate of yours, isn't he?
I prefer to call him an acquaintance, Brian.
Mark Militano, he went inside with you.
We're not going to be able to do business here if your boy keeps piping up.
Yeah, right. Militano, where is he?
He's on the hammer. Got a real hungry arm, too. God knows who he gets it from.
Where, Gus?
234 Flemington Road, Ted. Be on your toes, though. He's never far away from a shooter.
Don't worry, we'll get him.
And if Mr. Militano pops around for a visit, get your boys who are watching me from the other side of the road to look the other way, eh? Could be a bit of trouble just quietly.
Yeah, right.
You keep your nose clean, Gus.
Mate, I'm doing a community of service here.
I'll be doing the community of service too one day, Dennis, when I lock you up for good.
It's Gus. And go your hardest, pal. You know where to find me.
His career really blossomed, though, when he understood that selling drugs, as is today, you do require, again, some police assistance. And his greatest success was turning his police informing into a benefit for himself, that while he was involved in drug dealing and murder and extortion and you name it, he was putting in various armed robbers to police. There's one stage where he put in 33 armed robbers in a single year to a couple of detectives, Brian Murphy and Paul Higgins.
He was a bit upset about the way he's being treated, and I said, well, how do you expect to be treated? You're a drug dealer, you're most probably, it's alleged you've done a couple of murders, and, you know, who's going to treat you with kid gloves? I said, the only way you're going to get any relief is to give a smile. He wasn't too happy about that, but later got a phone call and he agreed to help us if we could facilitate any problems that he had. He was told that the only way we could help him was for mail, to be able to prove it, and then go to our bosses and say, well, he's done this, he's done that, is he worth a bunk up?
He was clearly involved in several murders, but the amount of information he was giving to members of the breaking squad and the consorting squad on other people, the crooks that he knew or was associated with, was incredible. So there were times when you had one set of Victoria Police who were trying to load Dennis Allen up with a gun and another lot who were trying to cut them off and give Dennis a warning and so forth. And it got to a ludicrous situation where he got bail in the most ridiculous circumstances. But he was that useful to certain police. I mean, it got to the stage where he felt so untouchable that he hatched a plot to blow up a court, for instance. Still got bail.
The armed robbery squad didn't say much at all. They were getting their results. We weren't telling them where we were getting them. Because one of the armed robbers might have got out in bail and gone and killed Dennis Allen. Myself and a couple of other policemen cop really bad flack as a result of the association we had with Allen. As far as I was concerned, the bosses that I trusted knew what was going on, and I didn't have to answer it to anybody else. And I wouldn't have either.
It's just a story of its time where police needed to be close to villains because there was no surveillance. You know, there wasn't that ability to stand back and monitor the events that were taking place. So officers needed guys like Dennis Allen who were prepared to help them while at the same time they turned a blind eye to other activities. So it really was an anomaly of the times.
Psychologist Francis Chua sees Allen's informing as behaviour consistent with that of a psychopath.
Normally, even among criminals, they have a code of ethics. And so normally they don't, you know, snitch on other people. But psychopaths are more likely to do that because they don't care. There's no sense of loyalty with a psychopath. So they're just going to do things to put themselves at an advantage, regardless of how it's going to affect other people.
It's not just a system of control. It's making sure that he remains king of the hill. So anybody gets in his way, he can get somebody else to do his dirty work for him, even if it is the constabulary. So, yeah, it's part of control, but it's also part of that manipulativeness that you see at the heart of people who've got psychopathy, that everybody else out there is there for my end. I can do with them as I will. And that's just the process that they go through.
By his 30th birthday, Allen was out of control. A potent cocktail of sleep deprivation and drug and alcohol addiction, combined with an already violent personality, made him extremely dangerous and unpredictable. Allen killed friend Wayne Stanhope in a wild flash of fury. Chopper Reed believes Stanhope was killed merely because he made the mistake of telling Allen that he visited Reed in jail.
Now, I remember he shot Wayne Stanhope. Wayne Stanhope came out of Geelong Prison to visit me. I forgot to tell him that I didn't get on well with Dennis Allen. I should have said, because he didn't tell me he was going to go and visit Dennis Allen. And then when he left me, he goes up to see Dennis Allen. And he goes into Dennis Allen's place at Stephen Street, Richmond. And Dennis said, where you been, Wayne? He said, I've just come back from seeing Chopper. He said, Chopper Reed? He said, yeah. He said, oh, Wayne Stanhope's got up to change his record. So Dennis Allen shot him in the back of the head with a 38 and buried the body, got rid of the body. And he did that because Wayne Stanhope came to visit me in Pendridge.
And I bashed Dennis Allen in Penchurch with a rolling pin.
Jason Ryan recalls the murder of Wayne Stanhope. Jason said it was his first that he witnessed at the hand of his uncle Dennis. Wayne was a so-called friend of Dennis Allen. They'd had a big session, drank a lot of alcohol, hit the amphetamines, and went back to Dennis's place and had a party. Stanhope was standing by Dennis's prized record player. For some unknown reason, Dennis pulled out a gun and shot Stanhope dead in front of all those witnesses. Jason tells me Dennis then grabbed another gun off him and fired several more rounds into Stanhope, who was then dragged off the carpet onto the kitchen so that he wouldn't bleed all over Dennis's favourite carpet in the lounge room.
Forensic psychologist Janet Hall points to a clinical link between Dennis Allen's psychological makeup and his drug use.
In researching the chemistry of sociopaths, one thing that they have found as a pattern is that they do have a high sensitivity to drug and alcohol addiction. So this suggests that their bodies and their minds crave some kind of flooding of euphoria.
If he was a long-term chronic user, it would actually mean that he'd be prone to paranoid delusions, so he's going to think people are out to get him. I mean, they probably are, but, you know. But it would just actually make it even more heightened. He'd have hallucinations. He'd also, there's a lot of confusion, so very confused thinking. Actually, the impulsivity would be increased, and so they're more likely to go off a lot or react more quickly. And I suppose all of that combined would just, if they're already prone to violence and criminal behavior, that might actually make them more reactive and, I suppose, more dangerous.
Well, look, if you're going to add in amphetamine, you get sleep deprivation, then you do get the paranoia and you get the hallucinatory phenomena, perhaps. But most importantly of all, you get the sleep deprivation, so you just become irrational in the way in which you think. So if you've got a guy who's already oriented towards being pretty maniacal in his violence, and then you add to that, you know, severe irrationality, you can get really random acts of pretty terrible stuff happening.
Kath Pettingill became increasingly concerned about her elder son's behaviour and the effect it was having on her family. She believed that Allen had trapped them in a cycle of violence and that only his death could release them.
Your mother's here. Dennis. Dennis, put away your fucking drugs and look at me.
Can't you see I'm busy, Ma? I don't mean to be rude, but fuck off.
I want to talk to you, Dennis.
Take a number. I'm a busy man.
I'm your mother. I'm not going to take a fucking number. OK, you go on dealing your drugs. You do what you have to do, but you leave Jason out of this.
Jason's doing fine.
He's 16, Dennis.
If you're tough enough, you're old enough. He's my boy, does as he's told, and he's learning heaps.
He's my boy and you are treating him like shit!
Stay out of my business. I'm setting him up.
You got him dealing your drugs. He's going to spend the rest of his life in bloody jail.
If you stick a bib in, I'll have him chopping up your body, Ma. How do you think this will look on the Christmas card this year? If you stick your nose in my business once more, Jason will be cleaning you off the wall, you dirty old bitch.
He would have ruled over his family through intimidation. He would have stood over them like he stood over other crooks. And he held that aura because of his reputation, and everyone knew that he could back that reputation up. I mean, he was a stone-cold killer. There was no doubt about that. The police knew it, other crooks knew it, and he just wasn't a man to be crossed.
You dirty old bitch.
And I think that from Mum to the rest of the family, they all tried to tag along with Dennis. I think they're all hell-bent on trying to outdo Dennis and his escapades. And I think they all fell well short of Dennis's cunning, his guile, and he's the master of intrigue.
So what he's doing is controlling the world around him. He's controlling the people who are in his world. So, I mean, he may be able to justify, he may have been able to justify to himself, hey, look, you know, I'm head of the family, I'm a warrior prince, but in reality what he's doing is controlling the people around him that he can control.
On the one hand, there's this, I will defend my family to the death, and if you're a threat to my family, then you're going to die, you'll be swept out of the way. And on the other hand, this continual pattern of behaviour that puts the family at risk. Alan being the most extreme, because he would actually get his family members involved in criminal behaviour. It's a statement, it's part of the facade. Look at me, I provide for my family, I protect my family, when in reality I'm putting my family at risk.
For years, the Victorian Police Force had been split on what to do with Alan. But by 1986, there was a determined effort to bring him before the courts. The police knew about Alan's murders, and with the use of listening devices placed inside his home, they built a case that would lead him to be charged with a string of drug offences and the murders of Helga Wagnag and Wayne Stanhope. His health was deteriorating through a combination of his heavy drug use and a rare heart condition. His protectors in the police deserted him. He was remanded in custody and would spend much of his time behind bars in the prison's hospital.
In the lead up to his death, Dennis Allen was a walking skeleton. He was a shadow of his former self. I mean, he was never a huge man. He was pretty weedy at the best of times, but due to his debilitating heart condition that was exacerbated by his chronic use of drugs, the man was fading away in his hospital bed. From my understanding, his heart condition was so bad that his heart was actually breaking up inside his chest. You know, for a man who a lot of people said didn't have a heart, it was ironic that his heart was crumbling and that was causing his death.
By May of 1987, Dennis Allen lay virtually immobile in his prison hospital bed. He was literally days from death. Allen understood his fate, and according to Kath Pettingill, Allen made a deathbed confession admitting to some of his crimes. However, this has not been confirmed by other sources. Dennis Allen did not seem like the type to make confessions.
Mr. Allen.
What do you want?
Good morning, Mr. Allen. How are you feeling?
I was thinking of running a half marathon. How about you?
Sorry, I know you're not feeling well. And this is because you're not well.
Where did they find you? Am I on candid camera or something?
Mr. Allen, you'd know that you're not well. You've been living with heart disease all your life. You were born with this condition. Unfortunately, your condition has been exacerbated by your drug use.
Exacerbated what?
Made worse, Mr. Allen. Put simply, your heart is disintegrating. Pieces of it are falling into your chest cavity.
So I'm off, you reckon?
It's time to put your affairs in order.
You're not a copper, are you?
No, I'm a doctor.
What sort of doctor?
A thoracic physician.
Why don't you get a copper in here?
Do you want to make a confession, Mr. Allen?
Yeah. It's time.
I'll see if I can find someone.
Don't worry. You got a pen and paper. Get this down. Here's me confession. I've got Azaria Chamberlain and Harold Holt living in me spare room.
If he made deathbed confessions, it would only have been to expand his reputation and to give himself an even greater reputation so that he would live on beyond death as this terrible monster, I suspect, rather than being an act of remorse.
He was playing both sides. He was running $1 million drug empire. He was killing people on a whim, as well as at the behest of others at times, for his own self-preservation. I think he just thought he was untouchable.
He ended up dying a multi-millionaire. I don't know what they did with the bloody money. When you say, you know, but he had it. I don't know where they put it. I don't know where they stuffed it or hid it. I don't know what mattress they hid it under, but I wouldn't mind knowing.
Well, there's a lot of polishing that goes on in these moments, aren't there? You know, and I'd be very surprised if the whole family did not know all the way through of what he'd been up to. So I think a deathbed confession might have been old news to most of them because it was done in such a public way. He felt untouchable. He could kill people at home. He didn't even need to take them out into the wilderness, just shoot them in Stevenson Street, Cremorne. I think he may well have had regrets, a lot of regrets, you know, because at the end, I know Kath Pettingill, she was terrified that he was infecting the whole family. She wanted him dead.
It got to a stage where I didn't know how it was going to end because we were all in trouble. I was out on bail. My young son was out on bail. My other young son had been murdered. I thought, where's it all going to end? I want a normal life. So I said to young Jason, I'm going in there and I'm going to have to kill Dennis.
So you actually seriously thought about killing your own
son? Yes, I did. I did. I was driven that far. To protect the others, I would have had to kill Dennis. This is just before his stroke on January the 19th, 1987. Yeah, I was seriously thinking about it all over Christmas.
Dennis Allen was just a complete fruit loop, you know, just a nutcase. What can you say about Dennis Allen? A complete nutcase. You know, a murdering, psychopathic, drug-crazed, genuine Aussie nutcase. A homebred, genuine Aussie nutcase.
To me, he served a purpose. To a lot of people, he's just a drug dealer and a murderer, and he lived by the sword and he died by the same sword. He died of overdose of drugs and alcohol, and he got his right whack.
The sign, Mr. Death is Dead, was painted on the Swan Street Bridge in Richmond by a graffiti artist. It was a fitting place for the message, Allen's own backyard, the suburb he had terrorised for almost 20 years. Allen was worn out and dead at 35. However, the graffiti lasted much longer. It was a long-standing expression of the profound relief felt on the streets of Melbourne. Mr. Death was dead.